I'm going to read from Matthew chapter 27. Matthew 27, I'm going to start reading at verse 15, and we're going to go through to verse 50. Matthew 27, verse 15. This describes some of the events leading up to the Lord Jesus' death. Some of the different things that happen. Matthew 27, verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And at that time they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. When he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that just man, for I've suffered many things today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governors answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?" They all said to him, "Let him be crucified." And the governor said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it." And all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. When they twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head, and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spat on him, and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified. And as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. And when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of a skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink. Then they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, "They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." Sitting down, they kept watch over him there, and they put up over his head the accusation written against him, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and another on the left. And those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, "He saved others. Himself he cannot save. If he's the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross and we will believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. Now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Some of those who stood there, when they heard that, said, "This man is calling Elijah." Immediately one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and offered it to him to drink. The rest said, "Let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to save him." And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And this is God's word. Well, Good Friday takes us to what must be the most horrific scene that's ever been recorded in human history. When it comes to the shock factor, things that are just awful and revolting, I think you can't help but read the account we've just read, and it is shocking. There are horrible things happening here. And I want to speak about one verse that I think helps us understand what's happening in Matthew 27. It's in verse 45. Matthew 27, verse 45. It simply says this: "Now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land." This was a darkness that lasted for 3 hours. And we're told that it covered all the land, that it doesn't hover just over the cross itself. Everyone, certainly amongst Israel, I don't know what all the land could just mean Israel. It could mean the whole planet. But certainly across Israel, the land is plunged into darkness. Luke gives us an extra detail in his account of it. He tells us the sun itself was darkened. Now, on one level, we don't know what caused that. It sounds like a solar eclipse, doesn't it? If the sun is dark, if you don't have the light of the sun anymore. But this event took place at the time of the Passover, a time of a full moon. And the experts say you can't have a solar eclipse when you have a full moon. So the Bible doesn't tell us what it was that caused this darkness. But we have a God who can make eclipses happen any time. We have a God who doesn't need to wait for the full moon to pass. We can have a God who can dim the light of the sun whenever he chooses. A God who isn't restricted by the laws of nature. So whatever it is that's happening physically here, it doesn't cause our faith any problems. And in fact, because we're not told, actually, there's a point at which we say, well, actually, we won't dwell on that. We simply don't know how God is physically making this happen. But we know it was dark. We know it was dark. I see there's some children here this morning. Children, I don't know where the darkest place you've ever been is. Ever been down the big pit? Ever been in caves? Ever been to the beach? Go to a cave on the beach. You know, these caves that are sort of at the side, by the away from the sand. And you start walking in, and to start with, it's quite light. But the further in you go, the darker it gets, and you get to a point where you think, I don't want to go any further into this because it's very dark and scary. Now, what do you do if you have a power cut? If you have a power cut, what's the first thing you do? You go and get a torch. Or you light candles if you don't have torches. And the reason I say that is people in this day, and that moment of darkness, would have been able to do the same thing. They would have been able to light fires. They would be able to have torches lit. So I say that because I don't think we're meant to imagine here a scene of utter chaos where everyone is running around bumping into each other in the darkness because they cannot see even 3 inches in front of them. The point here isn't a scene of chaos. It's what the darkness represents that makes it so poignant. It's what the darkness symbolizes. And I'll give you two things that this darkness is showing us happening. Here's the first one. The darkness shows us that Jesus was suffering at the unrestrained hands of his enemies. The unrestrained hands of his enemies. One verse I think is helpful for us here is Luke chapter 22, verse 53. In Luke 22, verse 53, Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Judas comes and he's leading this gang of chief priests and captains of the temple and the elders, and Judas comes and he betrays him with a kiss. And listen to what Jesus says to Judas. Luke 22:53, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you didn't try to seize me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness." Jesus is telling Judas, your time has come. This is your hour. And how does he describe it? He describes it as the power of darkness. Now, having enemies isn't new for Jesus. He's had them right the way through his life, hasn't he? But they've always been restrained up to this point. At the moment he's born, the very beginning of his life, there's a king out to get him, who wants baby boys dead, who's pursuing this King Jesus so he can kill him. But he doesn't get him. Herod's plan is thwarted. The wise men return home another way. Evil has been restrained. From the moment Jesus starts preaching publicly, he has people asking him questions, trying to catch him out, trying to publicly humiliate him. But he always gives wise answers. They can never trick him. Their plans just unravel again and again. You read through John's Gospel, you find again and again in that book people wanting to get him, but failing because evil is being restrained. For example, John 7, verse 30. Jesus is there in Jerusalem, and people want to take him, they want to arrest him, but we're told, here it is, John 7, verse 30, "Therefore they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come." John 8, verse 59, people pick up stones to throw at Jesus. But what happens? He just goes through the midst of them and carries on going. He just passes them by. John 10, verse 39, it's in Jerusalem. It's the Feast of Dedication, and Jesus is speaking about who he really is. And it says, "Therefore they sought again to seize him, but he escaped out of their hand." Luke chapter 4, verse 30. Jesus is preaching in a synagogue in Nazareth. And the things he says anger the people there so much that they force him out of the city. They take him up to the top of the hill. They have a plan of throwing him off a cliff. But we're told that Jesus just walked straight through them. Why? Because their evil plans are being restrained. They're not able to do what they want to do to Jesus. And Jesus has told us why. He says, it's because my hour has not yet come. God is keeping evil at bay. But now Jesus says to Judas, this is changing. This is your hour. The shackles have come off. You are going to be allowed to do your worst. This is the power of darkness. You know, we enjoy the restraint of evil every day. And we enjoy it probably without ever really thinking very much about it. I don't know how you came here this morning. You walked, you got in your car, and I trust you came here safely. Because evil was restrained. And it was restrained in part because of the way our society is structured. Think about if someone does come up to you and try to mug you. There are all sorts of restraints in place. There's the fact that you might be able to fight them back. There's the fact there might be other good people around who might help fight them off as well. There's the fact that people might phone the police, and they'll often be with you quickly. It's the fact that we have judges, we have a system of law and order, and those judges will not, at least normally, take bribes. They'll act fairly, they'll punish wrongdoers. And all those things and more are enough that most people walking down the street will therefore choose not to mug you. In all sorts of ways, just on a day-to-day basis, we experience the restraint of evil in our society. But then you start to imagine a lawless society, one where there is no justice system, one where people won't stand up for innocent people being mugged, a place where the police are too scared to go, a place where gangs rule the roost and act in impunity, do whatever they want in broad daylight. When restraint is removed, you start to see so much awful things like that. But I was watching a TV program that was saying about self-service checkouts in supermarkets. And they were saying, do you know, most people will not walk into a supermarket, shove something up their jumper and walk out. They won't steal like that. And the fact they have to go through a checkout where there's a human there will stop most of them from stealing. But when you have self-service supermarkets where you can just go and scan your own items, people steal in huge volumes because the restraint of people, of humans at the checkout, are acting to stop them normally, but that restraint is being removed. Well, what you have here is a period, Jesus says, where the power of darkness is going to be unrestrained. And that's what happens. That's what we've read about. You have false witnesses making up accounts about Jesus. And they don't seem to be worried about the consequences, the seriousness of what it is they're doing, lying about him. And justice isn't done. They get away with it. They're encouraged to do this. You have people spitting in his face, and no one stops them. You have people hitting him with the palms of their hands. You have Pilate. You know, what are rulers given to nations for? To restrain wickedness. And what does Pilate do? Given the opportunity, he caves into the braying mob and he hands Jesus over to be crucified. You have people mocking, insulting Jesus, saying, if you're the Son of God, come on down. You can do it if that's really who you are. In the hour of darkness, you can say what you like to Jesus. This is a free-for-all. That's what's been happening since Jesus spoke those words to Judas. Jesus has been on the cross from 9 a.m. to midday. He's been on the cross for 3 hours. And during those 3 hours, Calvary has been a hive of activity because the shackles are off, and everyone, it seems, wants a piece of Jesus. It's a scene brought to life by C.S. Lewis in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Aslan comes to the stone table where he's going to be executed. And there's this huge crowd of people there. He describes ogres with monstrous teeth, wolves, bull-headed men, spirits of evil trees and poisonous plants. And then he says, because he's writing a children's book, remember, he says, and other creatures who I won't describe, because if I did, the grown-ups would probably not let you read this book. Cruels and hags, incubuses, wraiths, horrors, efreets, sprites, orkneys, wooses, and ettins. A bit further on, he describes what they do. Says the hags made a dart at him and shrieked with triumph when they found that he made no resistance at all. Then others, evil dwarfs and apes, rushed in to help them, and between them they rolled the huge lion over on his back and tied all his four paws together, shouting and cheering as if they'd done something brave. Though had the lion chosen, one of those paws could have been the death of them all. Sobering picture, isn't it, of the forces of darkness unleashed on the Son of God. As I said, he's on the cross from 9 until 12 in the light. And then for 3 hours, it says from the 6th hour until the 9th hour, so that's from midday to 3 p.m., the sun's light goes out. Now, we're not really told what happens during those 3 hours. We've been told a lot of things about all the events leading up to this moment. But there's silence when it comes to what actually is happening during the 3 hours of darkness. Some people would suggest, well, it was just eerily silent. People were so spooked by this strange occurrence of darkness in the day that they all went quiet, and it was just an eerily strange atmosphere, and it left Jesus experiencing the silence of the cross. He couldn't even hear the voices of his enemies. I can't rule that out because we're not told, but I think there's something else I would say is more likely. This is what I would go for if I had to choose. I suspect that there are just some things that are unspeakably horrific that they just haven't been written down for us. You know, we've read about the spitting and the mocking and the violence, but we also know from the Bible, don't we, that evil people love the darkness because no one's there to witness their crimes in that moment. Is it possible they sunk into even lower pits of depravity in those 3 hours? Things that we've not been told about, and what they did to the Son of God in the darkness. As I say, we're not told. But what we can say with confidence is what we're reading about here is events that have never been witnessed before or since. This really is a moment of darkness for the human race. And the physical darkness is a symbol of that. It's a symbol of this unrestrained wickedness. Let's imagine just for a moment a kitten. I don't know if you're a cat lover. If you're a cat lover, I apologise for what I'm about to describe, and I hope this doesn't upset you. Imagine a kitten that's gone exploring up into the mountains. And on the mountain road, a car has just hit it. It's run over its back legs, and it can't move. Just sort of stuck there on the side of this mountain road. And night starts to fall, and the wolves start to circle and close in because they can smell blood. They're going for it. And they approach, they find this kitten, and there is nothing it can do. And they're ready to satisfy their thirst for blood. Well, Jesus here isn't powerless. I remember how C.S. Lewis described him, that lion who with one swipe of his paw can knock them all away. But in this moment, he makes himself powerless. He offers up no defense against his enemies. This darkness is a symbol of the unrestrained thirst for blood that Jesus' enemies have. And ultimately, it's a thirst for the blood of their maker. So that's the first thing the darkness represents. Represents Jesus suffering at the unrestrained hands of his enemies in the darkness. But secondly, Jesus was also suffering at the hands of his Father. Notice it's for 3 hours, from the sixth hour until the ninth hour. And then you look on at verse 46, about the ninth hour. So as the darkness is coming to an end, what is it that Jesus is thinking about? As Jesus starts to speak, there's all sorts of things he could talk about. He could talk about his physical suffering. He could complain about the injustice of it all. But what's his biggest cause of anguish? He cries out, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So his 3 hours of darkness point us towards that agonizing cry of abandon. Why has my Father left me alone? Why has he forsaken me? Imagine that kitten again, up on the mountain. But this time it's not there because it went exploring and got lost. This time it's there because its mother picked it up and carried it up the mountain and left it there alone. And the kitten is there meowing, crying out for its mum. But mum isn't coming to rescue the kitten. On the cross, God the Father abandons, forsakes his son, leaves him there on the cross. And he does it without disowning him. He does it without hating him. He does it without breaking the unity that's there in the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Apparently, when Martin Luther studied this verse, he sat down, he read this verse, he sat there for several hours, then he got up from his chair, he walked around the room, and he was overheard saying, "God forsaken by God. Who can understand that?" There's a sense in which we try as much as we can to understand what's happening here, but we can't fully grasp what's going on at the cross. But we can say, look, Jesus is saying himself, I am being forsaken, abandoned here. Every good thing is being withdrawn from him. Every act of reassurance from his Father. The warmth of the midday sun is gone. He hangs there alone. This is Jesus who from eternity past has enjoyed a perfect, blissful unity with his Father, a relationship that's never been broken, never been tainted by sin, by selfishness, by rudeness, by lack of consideration. Every human relationship is tainted by those things, but that one isn't. This is a perfect relationship. And now he's being left by his Father on the cross. But actually there's more yet to come. Because at the same time, his Father is present. He's involved. Because in these hours, he is also actively pouring out his anger for sin. Darkness is a picture of judgment in the Bible. One example, Amos chapter 8, verse 9. It talks about a day of judgment for Israel. It says this, "And it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord God, that I will make the sun go down as noon, and I will darken the earth in broad daylight." It's a picture of the judgment facing Israel. About how hell itself is described. A place of outer darkness. Judgment is what Jesus is experiencing at the cross. That God's righteous punishment for sin is being poured out upon him. Because either Jesus takes it for us or we take it ourselves. Just think about how hell is described. It said it's described as a place of darkness. It's a place of loneliness. It's a place where people grind their teeth together, but they don't get any relief. It's a place where even the worm never dies. Jesus is experiencing that loneliness. He's experiencing no physical relief from pain. He's experiencing darkness. Let's go back to that little kitten again. Apologies to you cat lovers. This is the point where I can't take my illustration any further. That there comes a point where in the Bible all you can really say is it's not like this. And it's not like that. I could say to you, imagine that kitten's mother sees those wolves attacking the kitten. And imagine the mother goes along and joins in with the other wolves. Yeah. High-fiving the wolves. Back-slapping them. Yeah, nice one. Good kill. But God the Father isn't joining in with his enemies. He's not joined their team. I could say, well, imagine the wolves come along and they start to do some damage. But then off they go. And then the mother comes along and finishes the job. But he's not acting separately either. On the cross, God is acting through his enemies. Using the darkest hour in the history of the world the forces of evil that have been unleashed with all their venom. And God is carrying out his purposes. The weight of the punishment of sin placed on Jesus' shoulders. He's treating his son as a criminal, as a murderer, as a thief who mugs people and leaves them trembling on the ground, as a war criminal. He's treating Jesus Christ as a sinner, giving him the judgment sinners deserved. And that includes the sin of everyone who trusts him. It includes our shameful acts, our pride, our greed, our self-centeredness that we deserve. That's what we deserved. That's what we're seeing at the cross. The horror of what we are seeing there, it should have been mine. But here's the great mystery of the cross. That in the hour Jesus describes to Judas as being your hour, the power of darkness, it is in fact God's hour. That in that moment he is lighting a lamp that will never go out. That he's making a path back to God from the dark paths of sin. That he is setting free every soul that will trust in him. And so that's why we can say this morning, the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. Jesus at the cross is suffering at the hands of his Father, experiencing our judgment, taking our punishment. As we draw to a close, the depths into which Jesus was plunged on that cross 2,000 years ago, that Friday morning, they're far greater than we will ever comprehend. There are things happening at the cross that are unspeakable in the sense that they're just so wicked. And there are things happening at the cross that are unspeakable in that human minds just cannot fully plumb their depths. And there are things happening at the cross that are unspeakable in the sense that they're so unspeakably glorious that human words in this world could never fully do them justice. What we can say with confidence is that this is the cross he bore for me, for everyone who trusts him. That just like Aslan, not raising his paw to swipe them away, Jesus experienced the darkness so I can come to the light. He experienced his Father's anger so I can know his love. He took my punishment so I can walk free. He took my sins, experienced the darkness, so I can say with confidence, heaven is mine. Jesus experienced the darkness so we can live in the light.